This is Houston, contact with a test one.
Touchdown to Crook.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Space Cowboys.
Welcome yourself, Thijs.
Oh, well, thank you, Herbert. Thank you so much. Everybody is welcome to listen in on this beautiful day.
Yes.
To this beautiful podcast.
Right.
Live from Earth.
Live from Earth.
Oh, it's not live, but semi-live, recorded from Earth into outer space.
Okay.
Yes.
Right now we're live. When people hear this, it's no longer live.
No, yeah. We usually record this and then we beam it out. There's no live version of this anymore.
No streaming version.
No. So we cut out all the bad words that Herbert says all the time.
We don't.
Herbert cusses all the time when the mic is off. So that's, you don't know that about Herbert, but now you do.
Okay, I confess.
We are here together in the studio. However, our guest today...
Is somewhere else.
Where is our guest?
Actually, I have no idea. I do know he's called Erik Laan.
Hi, Erik.
He's a space engineer. Hi, and a space educator. Mm-hmm. Does a lot of very nice work.
Yeah.
Erik, where are you anyway?
Yes, where are you?
I'm in Delft.
Oh, you're in Delft. Yes.
Okay.
Great. And Erik is big on the Twitters as well, and always... seems to be on top of anything that happens space-related.
That's right. You know him from Twitter.
I try.
Yes. So thank you, Erik, for for your service.
Yes.
And I once met Erik in person. I'm very proud
of that. I think I met Erik in person as well once.
But you're not sure.
We met at ESA, one of the NL Space Days or the Space Days, something like that. We quickly shook hands. It's been 2 years ago, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. It's okay if you don't remember, Erik. Yeah, it's okay. Well, I hear it in your voice, but it's okay. It's okay. I remember you. And so today we're going to talk.
Well.
Yes. This is going to be one of those episodes where we bring everybody up to speed of what's happening because so many things happen.
Sometimes many
things happen. Then it's good to reevaluate like where everybody's standing because
piles of news.
Because of all these piles of news about. Space exploration and what's next.
That's
and where
right.
we should go. So we're gonna go to stories of the week and then we'll take it from there.
Let's go.
Yeah. Who wants to start? Because
our guest, I guess.
Our guest. Yes, dear guest.
Okay.
Would you like to start?
Yes. Well, the story of the week, for me, it's obvious that is the Falcon Heavy launch that was 2 days ago. Mm-hmm. It was the third launch of the Falcon Heavy launcher. Built by SpaceX, and it was the most challenging one so far, as Elon Musk has pointed out.
Yeah, why was that? Why was it so hard?
Well, it was the most lengthy launch operations that they had. So normally they launch something and then, I mean, within the hour, the satellite is deployed and it's on its own. And then the launch is a success, despite maybe the satellite is being a failure, but then for SpaceX it is done. But this time it took 6 hours that they had to put 24 satellites in total into space. And all those satellites, they had different requirements for orbits. And so there was a whole timeline of when all those satellites were being deployed.
Okay, but the number itself is not a record, is it? Because they did 60 something a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, even 100.
Yeah.
The PSLV rocket by the Indians, they had, I believe, over 100 CubeSats. So these were all 24, like, and not huge satellites, but there were some nano satellites there, but some micro satellites, some bigger satellites, a few hundred kilos.
So it's the diversity, also maybe in orbits.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. But why is that so hard?
Well,
you have to pay attention.
you have to pay attention. It has to follow a timeline. They have to restart the upper stage. This time they had to restart it four separate times. So they have not before restarted this upper stage so many times. So there was like a new thing. But
they had to restart the upper stage.
Yes, yes. Hmm.
It only dawns on me now. That's really something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mostly a rocket burns up and then you're done. And
mm-hmm. Yeah.
They had to restart the upper stage. Okay.
Yeah. And so to release all these things, they had a lot of things on board.
They had a lot of things on board. And it was all, It has a bit of a military shade on it because there's many satellites built by military departments from the U.S.
Yeah, that they couldn't say anything about.
They couldn't say anything, but some were like just science experiments also performed by the U.S. Air Force. For example, they want to look at the solar weather, also the influence of solar weather on all the military satellites they have. And so there is a science department within the Department of Defense, and they had like an experiment to look at the sun with a very new technology, a new lens they had developed. So all kinds of technology demonstrations, science experiments they have been doing, also with new propellants, the so-called GPIM satellite, which is a demonstration satellite to show the green propellants, the work of them.
We talked about that last week. Yeah,
GPIM.
There was this alternative, slightly more safe fuel that NASA was testing.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So with normally they have hydrazine on board for all kinds of attitude control, and hydrazine is carcinogenic and it's very difficult to work with. Hydrazine, yes.
It's what you said sounded like hydrogen, but it's not that.
Hydrazine. Okay, great. Yeah, and they had it on board as well. Yeah, and they had the light sail on board?
Yes, yeah, the Planetary Society experiment.
Yeah, yeah. Talked about that last week, 2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago, yeah.
I'm not really sure.
A lot. And
time goes by so fast.
Yeah, and something peculiar that you came with, Herbert. What else did they have on board?
Hang on.
Okay, I'm going to help you.
What's that?
I'm going to help you. Yes, the remains of the ashes of many people. Hey, your
dead
idea
people,
to tell this story, Herbert.
Dead people on board, yeah.
dead people on board. Yeah,
that was a really weird story because there were actors there and astronauts and a whole bunch of...
ashes.
Famous people that I don't know the names of by heart, ashes of cremate, and not the complete ashes, because you can buy a place on a flight like this for your ashes, but you can only send maybe a teaspoon or something. Do you know this, Eric? Do you know the details of this?
Not for this specific mission, but I know that the Americans, they have done more cremated remains sent into space.
I'm looking it up right now.
So this is not the first time that they've been doing that. But I've never really understood why people would like to do that.
Because it's awesome, Eric.
Because it's awesome. The idea.
Yes.
Your ashes going into orbit.
Would you like to do that in the future with your own ashes?
I might, because it doesn't hurt. Who cares?
I see it as a bit of an orbital debris. That was my first response as well. Yeah, that was my first response.
And I don't know from the story I have on my screen right now, I don't know if the ashes... I suppose it's some kind of a capsule or something.
They're individual canisters containing the cremated remains of clients.
And do they stay in orbit, or do they go into an orbit that is so low that it decays and
they will burn up
in the atmosphere?
Yeah, they will burn up. So they will orbit until they re-enter the atmosphere, and then they become a shooting star. So
then
somebody makes a wish because of that shooting star, and then is that not a beautiful story?
Right.
Are we being cynical? we're not becoming cynical.
No,
old farts,
because you see this Thais Rus star coming down.
And a child will wish upon that star will later become something beautiful.
And then the wish will certainly become reality.
Yes, because it will be on my ashes.
Come true, yeah.
Yes. I see that Bill Pogue, former NASA astronaut, who was also on the support crew for the historic Apollo 11 moon mission, of course, he has also lived aboard Skylab, the space station. And so he was on there. Masura Tomito, a two-time all-star player, Japanese baseball player. Mm-hmm. Well, there you go. And another NASA colleague, Marge Kruger. So...
Well, now.
Now you know. So that was not the sole reason for the Falcon Heavy. The Falcon Heavy mostly went up for defense, right, Eric? That's the defense. That was the main reason why it went up for defense mission.
That's the other
stuff that all the media are reporting on is what
all
was
hitchhikers.
Hitchhiking, but that was the only thing that was unclassified. So.
Okay.
Yeah. And the center core, again, this is an interesting story about that center core. Again, they were unsuccessful in recovering it, right? So the first time the Falcon Heavy ever launched, it went brilliantly, but the center core, they lost it. Then the second time, it again went brilliantly. The center core landed on the drone ship as well. But then on the way back to Florida, the choppy waves made it plunge into the ocean, And so then this time, I think it landed completely next to it. You saw it explode underwater, I think. So again, like for the third time, but it doesn't really matter. Like I'm pretty amazed that this thing is flying at all.
Yeah, but they had it. They said before the launch that it would be very difficult to put it on the barge safely.
Yeah. They were basically preparing for
really
failure.
Plant capabilities.
I mean, why was it more difficult than some other time?
No, because the payload of Falcon Heavy was so full compared to the previous launches.
But how does that make the return trip more difficult?
And they had to go way farther, I believe.
They had to use more fuel to get the upper stage into an orbital trajectory.
And then you have less fuel available to steer your way back home.
Yes. So they skipped one of the entry burns. And so they had a very tough landing burn, a longer landing burn. But then, it is more difficult to really point to the barge on the ocean.
So it's still remarkable that they got so close. It was only like 10, 20 meters off. But, you know, it's still
one zero thing, you know.
that is true. It's like either it lives or it doesn't. Yeah. No, true. Okay. Do we now cover the Falcon Heavy? I think we covered the Falcon Heavy.
More or less. Good enough.
Because there was other big news. Or maybe not. But it was the... I was so amazed by the puff of methane on Mars that Curiosity suddenly detected.
Yeah.
And it was really, you don't know if this is really a sign of life or not, because methane can come from some biological process, geological processes or from biology. What I thought was so remarkable was just like, if we do find aliens one day, this is probably how the news will come. There will be like an anomaly somewhere.
There will be a puff of methane.
A puff of something.
Fart or something.
Exactly. This is weird. We don't know what's going on over here. Like, it won't be suddenly E.T. waving into the camera like, hey, here we are. Yeah, exactly. But it will be like this weird headline of like, hey, that's weird. That's odd. And then you start diving in deeper, I guess. And then it will... they will pop up. I mean, in this case, you can't really say anything about it because there was a poof of methane that Curiosity sniffed, and that was super weird. And it was in the middle of Gale Crater, right? Then it was gone.
Yeah.
And then it was gone. It was not like tried to redo the experiment. They tried to see if there was anything left still. And then everything was back to normal.
Didn't they go back and have another puff?
They tried, but it was back to
normal.
Back to normal.
All values. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it was, let's see, it had spiked to 21 parts per billion. I don't know. That's a lot, supposedly. And then it went back to
It's supposedly normal. A lot. But you know, I compared this to the concentration of CO2 in our atmosphere.
Okay.
That's about 400 parts per million. All right.
Yeah.
So
that's true.
More than 1,000 times a higher concentration than the methane that Curiosity detected in the Mars, which is more thin to begin with.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really incredible that you can detect this, and then it's still much higher than you can decide. It's much higher than usual.
Than usual. Yeah. Exactly.
Incredible.
Yeah. What do you make of it, Eric?
Well, the methane on Mars. Yeah, that's a very interesting thing. I remember that the Mars Express mission from the European Space Agency back in, I believe, 2003, they were, I think, the first to measure it from space with the Fourier spectrometer on board. And they found also these very low concentrations of methane. And actually no other experiment has ever since really detected these levels. And they have a special orbiter around now, the ExoMars orbiter, mm-hmm. that is preparing for the ExoMars lander as a communication orbiter. But that also has a methane spectrometer on board. And I know that they have a very hard time detecting the methane again. So it's a very difficult thing. So they found it actually with this Curiosity measurement, but they couldn't detect it again from space with the orbiter. So the concentrations are very low.
Yeah.
But I think, yeah.
And which orbiter were you specifically talking about?
The ExoMars.
Oh, ExoMars, yes. And yeah. Because I have the New York Times article in front of me here. Because I remember when it happened a few days ago, I believe it was also sort of like half classified. Scientists had sort of found it out, but usually they do decent studies and then they publish it when there's anything to publish. In this case, it was just Curiosity that did something and it just sort of leaked. And
methane leaked.
True. Yes. The news leaked like the methane itself. And it says here that Mars Express passed over Gale Crater the same day as Curiosity saw that spike. And it has some results. It was looking down as well. So maybe...
Okay.
So it has not yet reported its own results from that day. Scientists working on the two European orbiters, the New York Times writes, are still analyzing recent measurements. And until that is done, Marco Giurana says, who is in charge of the Mars Express instrument, we cannot say anything more. So it's sort of like the puff came and the puff went. And everybody's like, what the hell? And now nobody knows what really happened. So stay tuned. Stay tuned. One day we will understand what this puff was.
Yes.
One day.
One day.
One day. Now on to Herbert and his long list of fun facts in space week.
It's just a couple of tidbits. Where shall I begin? Oh, yeah. There's this survey that was done by, drum roll please, the Center for Public Affairs Research. They surveyed 1,137 US adults and asked them stuff about space.
Okay.
And what comes out? I'll tell you. 86. Sorry.
What did they ask?
60. Lots of stuff. Listen, 86, no, once again. 68% thinks it's important to monitor asteroids, comets, and other events in space that could impact Earth.
It's very or extremely important.
Yeah.
So almost 70% of people says it's very
extremely important to do that kind of research.
Yeah.
So that's about comets, asteroids, plunging down on Earth
and destroying us all,
destroying the climate, killing dinosaurs and what have you.
Yeah. So people don't see it as science fiction. People think it's actually very important,
at least to do research and protect yourself against such events.
It's because of Deep Impact and Armageddon.
Yeah, but it's a feeling of self-interest. This affects us. This could affect us.
But most people are not that aware of it, I think. Are they?
Well, apparently they are.
Yeah, I guess they are now. Maybe they're... Yeah.
Let me go down the list. Because,
yes.
Or up the list. In the order that Ars Technica publishes it. I read it there. They also think it's very or extremely important to... 59% of them do. To conduct scientific research to expand knowledge of the Earth, solar system, and the universe. Short way to put this, astronomical research.
Yeah, science.
All right?
To do science. So a lot of people are pro-science. Okay. That's good.
Next on the list, very important, say 47%, send robotic probes without astronauts to explore space. More astronomy. Okay.
More astronomy, yeah. So 50-50 on robots.
The earlier one was like using telescopes, and this last one was do astronomy by spacecraft. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now it gets interesting, because 42% prefer to continue funding the International Space Station. That's the first item of manned spaceflight.
That's true, yeah.
Okay? Next on the list is 34% like search for life on other planets. That's another astronomy thing.
Yeah, so one third of people thinks it's very or extremely important to look for life. Yeah.
And then this last one I'll mention, only 27%, no, I'll do two more, 27% prefer to send astronauts to Mars, and only 23% mention return astronauts to the moon.
Yeah.
So manned spaceflight is relatively low on this list.
Yeah, it
and
doesn't
all kinds
say
of
like
astronomy research is high on the list.
Yeah, that that is very interesting.
And that's right, and that's fun because if you talk to astronomers, most of them will have the same ideas because doing unmanned research into space and the universe give you a lot more science bang for your buck than if you send people up.
It's way too dangerous and expensive to
keep people alive in space.
Yeah, yeah.
And we may think it's awesome, and it is, to have manned space flight. But the interesting thing is, in America at least, the idea is you have to send people up in order to keep the public interested.
Yeah, and make your mark on history, I guess. Yeah,
it's not true.
Yeah.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So that I wanted to talk,
well,
tell you that.
There's a difference between, of course, keeping the public interested and what you think is important from a policy standpoint. So I think it's important that our water is clean. That doesn't necessarily, it means that I want to read about it every day.
Okay.
So sending people into space is awesome television. Just saying.
Absolutely.
Eric, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, putting people in space for human spaceflight, as I call it. I never use the term manned spaceflight because I think also women should go in space.
Very good
going
point.
Into space. Yeah, the human aspect, it always triggers the imagination more. And I just found out also 2 days ago with this Falcon Heavy launch that was in the morning at breakfast, and my kids were at home because there was a day for study of the teachers, so we had the kids at home. And I said, well, let's go watch this launch on television.
Cool.
As a breakfast.
It was like around 9 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, so excellent time. But the first thing my daughter asked, are there people on board? I said, no, these are just 34 satellites and they're doing nice experiments. But then she lost interest. I mean, she watched the launch, but it was less exciting for
just
her.
Just some fireworks.
And then if there were people on board, you know, so it does really weigh in.
Yeah,
exactly.
Because they might die, and that's exciting.
Yeah.
Or they might live, and that'll be exciting too.
Oh, yes, of course. That's true. Yeah.
Yeah. But one linguistic point, which I read some time ago, so a couple of days ago, about the Dutch language gender stuff.
Oh.
Like manned spaceflight, you know, the point Eric made just now. Man and manned and all that have become gender neutral.
Gender neutral, okay.
Yeah. Because you're not going to say woman space flight or person space flight.
I think
stupid.
men came up with that rule. I like human space flight better.
Yeah, in English, it's human space flight.
Yeah, human space flight.
Dutch,
okay.
You have to say bemenste ruimtevaart. It doesn't sound.
No. No,
at all. So there's no good Dutch word.
Well, bemenste, let's not devolve into a discussion about Dutch, but actually I would support that. Bemenste antwoord. More thing about that list. What I thought was actually almost like the most ironic thing about that whole list is that the bottom two are exactly
the ones I didn't
mention. The bottom three, the ones you didn't, that you mentioned, return astronauts to the moon, only 23% says it's very, very or extremely important.
Yeah.
However, It is the policy of the United States right now to return astronauts to the moon, to That's establish right. the permanent human presence on other planets, and, well, military presence, and to establish a U.S. military presence in space. And it's so funny because those are the bottom three, yet they are the top three of the of sort of like the new Trump's administration's policy. So yeah. there you have it. I'm not sure how politically motivated these answers are, but it is kind of funny to see that, especially those three, specifically those three bottom issues are the top three priorities of the U.S. government right now. So, yeah, interesting.
We'll put it in the show notes and you can have a look for yourself.
Herbert, the next one.
All right. Yeah. Fun item here is the Winklevoss twins.
Eric, you know the Winklevoss twins?
Yes, I know them.
How do you know them? What do you know them of?
Well, I know them from the movie on Facebook.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's right. They're the guys that said one day, you know, this Facebook thing that Mark Zuckerberg is working on, it was actually our idea.
Yeah, it was their idea, and now they're big Bitcoin entrepreneurs.
Yeah, they sued Mark Zuckerberg. They won lots of Facebook shares worth about $65 million. And when Facebook went public, the shares were worth about $200 million or so. So filthy rich. And in 2009 or something, maybe 2010 or 11, they bought $1 million worth of Bitcoin, which was at $10 or thereabouts at the time. So they have 100,000 Bitcoins. They're filthy rich in Bitcoins now as well.
This is beyond the point of filthy. This is like they're just in...
They're billionaires. Now they're billionaires in Bitcoin. And they're so rich, they could afford to buy a ticket on Richard Branson's rocket as tourists.
As tourists. So they're going to space.
Well, if Branson makes it to space.
Yeah, if he finally is going to make it this year, right? He said.
So
they said actually July 19th. I'm going to Google if they're still up. So
mind that.
Herbert,
Yeah, they bought a couple of years ago, they bought their tickets, paying $250,000 a piece. And they paid in Bitcoin. And the Bitcoin was at $800 then. All right. As we speak, the Bitcoin has risen in value to about $12,000. So they have, in retrospect, they have paid about 15 times too much.
Yeah. Way too much.
Tyler Winklevoss published this by tweet, adding, I won't make that mistake again.
Yeah, exactly.
And I'm wondering why he made the mistake in the first place, because they bought their Bitcoins assuming that it would go up in value. And now they're surprised that it did.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay,
well. Weird.
It's their problem, not mine.
By the way, Virgin Galactic, I quickly Googled it. Can't find it yet. They promised to finally take up tourists this year. I believe on July 20th, after 50 years after the moon landing. They said it once in February, but there's no update on that.
Yeah, I remember that also, that Richard Branson said something like that.
Yeah.
And that he would be on that flight, the first flight that would go for Virgin Galactic, that he would be on it together with his family to demonstrate, look how safe
All
it is.
Safe,
that I'm doing this. But I haven't heard much from that from that news anymore. But
we'll see.
It's the kind of thing that's always next year.
I like I said a couple of months ago, I visited the site in 2010, and back then
the actual launch site,
the actual launch site in New Mexico near Truth or Consequence. Very nice little town in the middle.
It's called Truth or Consequence.
Yes, it was named after a
awesome
radio radio show in the 50s. There was a radio show called Truth or Consequence in America, and there was some sort of contest or whatever. Something weird happened where the town said, like, if we win this or whatever, we will rename ourselves according to the name of the radio show. And so it happened. So it's Truth or Consequence. It's a hot spring town, so you can go there and just go chill in these hot springs. There's all these spas that they built, and then about, I think it was like a half hour, like an hour drive from there, there's the Virgin Galactic base. the spaceport, Spaceport America, as they say. Clear, open skies, almost bright skies almost throughout the year. They get like, I think like they're a mile or like 2 miles up. So that's also good. They get that for free, as the guy said. But when we were there in 2010, we constantly thought like, hey, this is going to happen any moment now. And then, yeah, of course, they had the accident.
Guy died.
Yeah, lost his life. And
test pilot.
Yeah, and now it's 2019, and we're waiting for
nothing.
It. So,
yeah,
Eric.
Okay,
it's we have to wait for it, right?
Yes, it's a bit. I think a bit of a disappointment. If you go even further back in time, it was 2002 that Spaceship One won this X Prize for suborbital flight.
Yeah.
And then Richard Branson jumped on that plane and said, okay, let's now do it. It was really, only a few years away as it was projected.
Yeah, exactly, right?
And then now we are 17 years later. And
still hasn't happened. Yeah.
No.
We'll see.
Okay. We'll talk about space tourism a bit more while we discuss Blue Origin. But first I'll have my last news item. And that is... Today is our recording day is 26th of June.
Okay.
On the 2nd of July, so that's 6 days from now, there'll be a total solar eclipse.
Oh.
It will be in South America.
I read about that.
Argentina and Chile.
And Chile, and not just anywhere in Chile.
No. So where?
Well, I believe it's gonna go over one of the observatories there.
Is it?
Yes. One of the observatories is going to clearly look into... Look at.
I sort of missed that, but
I saw a headline somewhere.
Suppose, yeah.
Eric, do you happen to
they're
know?
They're probably going to point the thing.
I
at
know
the
that.
Eric, go
sorry.
Ahead.
No, what I do know is that the European Southern Observatory, the ESO, they have organized a trip for a number of people on Twitter that they selected to go there.
Oh.
And to to be there. To experience a solar eclipse, but I'm not sure if there is like really an observatory in the path, and I would doubt that those observatories would actually look at the
at the sun.
I mean, they could look at the sun at the moment of eclipse, but if just the sun comes behind the moon again, then you destroy these type of telescopes.
let me tell you this. ESO will air a raw, I'm quoting from space.com, will air a raw feed of the total solar eclipse from the Atacama Desert in Chile. Cool. The live stream won't include commentary, but it will switch between sources to show the views seen by three telescopes. Bad weather or poor internet connection could change that, ESO officials said in a description of the webcast. The webcast will start at 3:15 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, which is 19 hours, 15 minutes GMT.
Okay.
And it will start 1 hour and 24 minutes before totality. Live views will continue until the eclipse ends.
Nice.
You can watch it at, this will be in the show notes, eso.org/public/live.
Yeah. Have you ever seen an eclipse?
Yes, I personally witnessed a total solar eclipse twice.
Twice?
Yes.
And you, Eric, what's your count?
Also twice.
Oh,
yes.
Man.
And you?
Yeah, I went twice, I guess, but one I couldn't see anything because it was cloudy. There was one in France.
Oh, man.
And
1999.
And then the other one was in the States 2 years ago. And that was brilliant and perfect.
Yeah. Both times.
My old hometown in Oregon.
Both times I saw one. The weather was cloudy, and the clouds opened up just in time. Both times.
Oh yeah, really?
Once in Finland in 1990, and once in I was in France in 1999.
Were you on the coast?
I was in near Verdun.
Oh, okay. And you, Eric? Okay. What are your two eclipses?
Well, I was 1999. I was somewhere in the east of France, and it was completely cloudy, but it was still such an impressive experience that you really. You could see the shade
coming over the hills.
Come in. I couldn't even see the sun, but it was a very impressive experience.
Well. Yeah, yeah.
It was. Yeah, so then I decided that 2002, I went on a trip to Zimbabwe and Zambia. Where there was an eclipse.
To see the eclipse.
And it was brilliant. I mean, it was blue sky, and just magnificent experience.
Yeah, yeah, very nice. So
in Finland, I went to see the eclipse in 1990, and I discovered not just the eclipse itself, but I also discovered that there's a community of solar eclipse hunters. Yeah. And show up each and every time, awesome. if possible.
They're addicted to the eclipse.
Yeah, you go there, you find the same people over and over again. Awesome. It's really funny.
Yeah, really cool.
You should interview Fred Espenak. He is the solar eclipse specialist. He's now retired. He used to work at NASA.
Oh, good idea.
But he keeps a very interesting website on all the eclipses that go on worldwide.
Yeah. Very good idea.
Okay, thank you. MrEclipse.com.
Yeah.
Yeah. MrEclipse.com. Awesome. Thanks for that.
Hey, let's talk Blue Origin.
Yeah, let's talk Blue Origin.
Okay.
Because I asked Eric to take part in this podcast. It was probably when Blue Origin presented their Moonlander, or at least I got the idea at that time.
Yeah.
And then started looking around for something to tell us about Blue Origin. And so, Eric, here you are.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the original business case for Blue Origin, because I seem to think that this was space tourism, wasn't it?
That was the original thought. And the idea, of course, came from Jeff Bezos, the CEO of Amazon.
Yep.
And as a youngster, he always was fascinated by space, like also like Elon Musk, basically. And he, about 2000, he started this company after he saw a science fiction movie and discussed it with a science fiction writer. He said, okay, I want to start a space company. He wanted to open up space for more private access. So basically tourism. But I think not strictly tourism, but also to look at space as also a space where you can do economy, where you can do off-earth, do business, have facilities to manufacture stuff and to have people live there. Yeah, basically extended land from the earth. So that's what also the name Blue Origin comes from. Blue Origin, then the earth is the origin, the blue earth.
Okay.
That is that's the starting point. And then space is just extended land basically to live and to work. That was the origin of the vision.
An extension of Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so he started back in 2000, and for many, many years it was really a secret what he was doing. And it was obvious that he was buying land somewhere in Texas, that he would buy pieces of land and they all added to each other to make a very big area. And it was all a big unknown what he was up to. And also the people working for him, they were all silent. And then at some point he came out saying, okay, I have this rocket, this new Shepard. I'm going to do suborbital tourism first. And that's the first step towards that vision of bringing the extended space under the reach of private people and private enterprises.
Let's talk about that first. Because we just told one another that Richard Branson is promising this space tourism thing for next year, and it's always next year. So how far is Jeff Bezos toward realizing this?
Yeah, I think actually he's further than Richard Branson. And this new Shepard vehicle that he has built has now performed 10 suborbital flights. To an altitude up to 107 kilometers, so really above the Kármán line.
Yeah.
And
so that he has reached space.
He has reached space, and he has reached it with a capsule that can have 6 people in. And the expectation is that somewhere in the second half of this year that will actually happen. And to have the first really commercial suborbital flight. I would bet my money on the new Shepard from Blue Origin to have that first achievement.
But he hasn't sold any tickets, has he?
No, he hasn't gone that route. And I think that's also a good choice. If you see the ticket sales for Virgin Galactic, that had started like, I think, back somewhere in 2007 or 2008, people have down paid that €250,000.
Yeah.
And they have haven't received anything in return until now. I know they've been to many parties worldwide, all these wannabe astronauts, basically.
Yeah.
So there's kind of a community of those people that bought those
tickets. Any of those people have already died?
I haven't heard stories about it, but some people really said, I want my money back.
Yeah.
So some cases, and I don't,
wish I had bought a Bitcoin.
Exactly. Yeah, so I think Jeff basically just, he will sell those tickets, and he will sell them, I think, for more or less the same price. And he doesn't need the down payment, I think. He has money, sufficient money to fuel his endeavors. But
because he's the richest person on earth.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. And what I didn't know is that he was already working on it since 2000, you said. I guess I identified other people with space more than him, so I always saw him as a latecomer. But I'm hearing from you that he was working on this for years already.
Visionary,
actually.
Because I saw him talk about the moon lander, and I was sort of skeptical, like, oh, really? It was a little bit new to me. He was talking about his backstory and that he was always interested in space and all that stuff. So, and I thought to take it with a grain of salt, but no.
So shall we jump to this moon lander? Because that's
the moon lander. Yeah.
What got me going in the direction of Erik Laan, finally.
Okay.
Should we take this thing seriously?
Jeff Bezos'
moon lander?
Yes, very much. This moon lander. They have been working on this lander for about 2 or 3 years, and so there's a high detail in that design. They've also developed the so-called BE-7 engine, which is necessary for this lunar lander to be able to land safely on the moon.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing with this lander is this BE-7 engine needs to be highly throttable. So you want to restart, to be able to restart it, but also be able to restart it with a fraction of the thrust, of its maximum thrust.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they've developed this moon lander. They've shown already tests that this is a good engine.
So and they have hardware. It's not just a design.
They do have hardware. Yes. That's one of their prides that they say we do things with hardware, and that's what you see more in the new space business, that there is earlier steps towards making hardware. The same you see with SpaceX. And basically the old space works still in a way that you first prepare a lot of documentation on what you want to build. And then you do all kinds of analysis, and then only at the final stage, let's make hardware. And then things go wrong, and you have to go back to your design, and then things get very expensive. But this new space, one of the things that's different is that they go earlier to making hardware, because they understand that many things go wrong when you do hardware. So So Blue Origin, they have lots of hardware in house. So and this moon lander, I think this is a very likely candidate for this 2024 moon landing, if it happens.
Isn't this too big a step for Bezos? He's been working on suborbital flight all the time so far, and suddenly he shows up with a moon lander and he's talking about going to the moon.
But if you look at the people that he hired, and I know some of them, they come from all kinds of they're very good engineers that worked on many missions already. So he has the expertise that he just drawn in Blue Origin. So it's all about, in the end, the people that you need for building such a lander. And he has the right team.
And does he have the capability? I mean, or does he need to sell his moon lander to some other party?
In the end, he needs to sell it, of course, and his prime objective is now to sell it to NASA for this 2024 moon landing. But I know that there is also commercial interest in landing on the moon. And the question is that really a viable business case? And when will that business case really be there? And how much business can you expect from that? Because I remember there was a company about eight years ago that was called the Golden Spy Company, and that was run by Alan Stern, which is also the scientist behind the Pluto mission,
New Horizon.
Yeah. He has set up a company, the Golden Spy Company, and he was going to sell tickets for two people to the moon for $1.5 billion.
I remember.
That was
just a trip around the moon, right?
No, that was really landing.
Also
on the moon.
Landing. Okay.
Yes. So, and basically he showed that there was commercial interest in it. So there are people that have that kind of money that would like to spend it to be like for a week on the moon.
And what was the price again for such a trip?
$1.5
billion. $1.5
billion. For two people.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Well, there's always billionaires around.
Yeah.
Just need a couple. Yeah.
But there's
a little market.
There's a market, but for a moon lander, I thought it was such an odd. If the goal is to sell it to NASA, it's such a specific goal that the whole development of that thing must cost so much money, and then he's betting the barn on just
and
trying to sell it to NASA.
One of the things that you see in the space industry that's being discussed about this going back to the moon is not to do it like in the Apollo days, to go there and to put the flag and go back, but to stay there and to build a colony.
A service station, to
industrialize the moon. And so that's where Jeff Bezos has his eyes set on for the future, that there will be like facilities on the moon. And so he just takes, what do we need first to get that vision working, that we have facilities on the moon for all kinds of material harvesting. Yeah, we need to land there first. So he's just taking
the
first step.
We need a rocket, we need a lander. Yeah.
Yeah.
And a spade.
Yeah, exactly. And yeah. So the next thing is, he will have habitats that he will sell.
Exactly. I'm certain that he will take that also.
Oh, funny. Yeah, okay. Okay. I mean, now it starts making sense. He's working on something that he might actually have a vision.
Yeah, he certainly has. The only question is, will it come
through? And he has more his eyes set on the moon also. Like Elon Musk, he is really into Mars. To go to Mars with this.
Aim
with
higher
this.
In a way.
But Jeff Bezos is more into the moon.
And what do you think? Who has the upper hand?
Well, for just accessibility, the moon will be first. And I think Elon Musk also acknowledges that. He said, for his BFR, the big Falcon rocket that he's being developing in the end to bring people to Mars, people asked him, do you think, will you go first to the moon or Mars? He said, the moon. We will, before we take off for Mars, we will certainly go first to the moon with this thing.
Yeah.
Because it's so close by and something goes wrong, it takes 2-3 days and you're back.
But if you compare technology achievements, Elon Musk certainly has the upper hand because he can reach orbit and Jeff Bezos hasn't shown that.
Yeah, exactly.
They still haven't reached orbit, right? Yeah. That's
true. They have this new rocket that they're also developing. It's called the New Glenn.
And this is Blue Origin again, right?
Blue Origin, yes. Yeah. And that's basically a rocket that will likely fly somewhere 2021. But there's nice pictures of it, or you can find on internet.
Yeah, what is the difference between New Glenn and New Shepard? New Shepard is a suborbital.
So that's about 18 meters tall.
Okay.
Reaches 107 kilometers. But this New Glenn, that will be a rocket of 82 meters tall.
Wow.
It will be able to put 45 metric tons into low Earth orbit, or 13 metric tons to a geostationary orbit.
Oh, wow. And it will be the competitor of the Falcon Heavy in that regard.
In a way, yes. Yeah. It will be a competitor to Falcon Heavy. Yeah. And they all the upper hand they have with New Glenn is that it will have a fairing of 7 meters, where Falcon Heavy, I think, has about 5.6 or 5.7 meters. And so 7 meters fairing. And actually, this Blue Moon lander that they developed, it could fit in this New Glenn rocket.
Uh-huh.
Mm. So there's no other rocket now that could actually fit this blue moon lander.
Well, that's except, important.
Yeah, that's important. I mean, it could fit in the SLS if that's ever
if that's ever going to happen.
Ever come off the ground.
The SLS, the space launch system that NASA is developing.
Yeah.
So to turn this around, no rocket in existing at this point could harbor the blue moon moon lander.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Blue Origin,
Blue Moon.
Oh, it's the lander.
The Blue Moon. Yeah, it's called the Blue Moon.
Oh, so it's called the Blue Moon.
It's called Blue Moon.
My bad.
Never mind. All right.
What is strange is that it's one of those top companies, but it hasn't had the same level of achievement yet as the other ones. Yet people are already talking about it. So because it's Bezos, so he almost has like endless resources, so to speak, because he's just so rich. Is that then where it ends? Like, doesn't he need to show some like quick success now?
No, I don't think so. I mean, that's what you see. He funds his company like with his $1 billion a year from selling his Amazon shares.
A billion.
And what you basically see is that he doesn't need other investors. So he doesn't need like marketing campaigns to show how good he is and what his plans are. He just,
That's right. And Elon Musk needs to keep selling his Falcon rockets. No. He just needs to assign from NASA over and over again in order to keep developing his idea for a Mars mission.
Yeah.
And Jeff Bezos doesn't even need that. He can just pump in $1 billion a year into his Blue Origin.
But I think SpaceX is now valued at about $30 billion. SpaceX is valued at $33 billion. Is there that was recently because of some private investment, I believe they because of a fundraising effort, they could see like okay, so probably around $30 billion. Can we say anything similar about Blue Origin?
Is Blue Origin the company is?
Yeah, I if you look at the SpaceX, it's now what you say $30 billion valuation. But if you look at how many people work there, I think it's about 5,000 to 6,000 people.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at Blue Origin, my estimate, and this is just an estimate, is about maybe 1,000 people. So it's a factor of 5 smaller than SpaceX.
Yeah.
For what I think.
Google is helping out on this one. It says 2,000, but that's indeed
2,000.
Yeah, 2,000
people.
But still, that's a lot less. And and so. Maybe the people that work there would eventually also, they would like to see these rockets fly. But I guess they're just, it will take a couple of years and then Blue Origin will be just as normal as a player as SpaceX is now.
Yeah, I think they will just, with this new Glenn rocket, I'm very sure this rocket will be there. They have developed the engine. They've been public about it, the BE-4 engine. That works. And so it's a question of now building this huge rocket.
Yeah.
And I'm sure they will get to the launch pad with this rocket.
Yeah.
And they will go public when they think it is needed. Maybe that's 10 seconds before the launch, but this launch will happen with this new Glenn rocket. My guess would be 2021. And there is also already customers lined up for... in their manifest to go to space. So,
well, why though? Because these customers now have existing options already.
Yeah. So these type of customers they like to have multiple providers for launches because launching satellites is still in a risky business. Eh? You still need to cover your insurance when you put an expensive satellite on a rocket.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just basically also demand from the insurance companies to if you have many launches like these telecom providers, that the insurance companies tell those companies, okay, you have to make sure that you diversify your launcher portfolio. Mm-hmm. So that's why they just go also to New Glenn.
Yeah. Yeah, what will happen now that there's such a big battle between these newcomers? What will happen to the old ones? What will happen to the Russian rockets,
ULA,
so to speak?
Yeah,
or the ULA, like all these things.
Yeah, for the Russian rocket, the Proton, and they're developing the Ankara 5 rocket. I'm not so positive about where that's going to, that they can compete with the level of innovation, eh? Yeah. And also the power that is now in SpaceX.
Mm-hmm.
It will be very hard, and they will still have these launches just for national access to space, like the Europeans have also this drive to have European access to space. That's one of the drivers to have Ariane launchers.
Yeah.
So even if Ariane 6 becomes a commercial failure, it will still happen because Europe wants its own access rocket, to space.
Yeah.
Point. That's no. But in this commercial sector, I think Ariane 6 will be able to compete. But Proton, I doubt that. And ULA, they are going for also a new rocket, the Vulcan.
Okay.
Not to. There's also Falcon, but this is the Vulcan rocket.
Vulcan.
ULA.
Vulcan.
And they actually have the same engine as the New Glenn. So the BE-4 engine developed by Blue Origin will fly on this Vulcan rocket.
Yeah, Blue Origin is selling rocket engines.
Yes. Yes,
to
the competitor. Right? So that's
interesting.
Yeah, but I think ULA has a special place. I think in the space in the United Space program, especially also in the defense launches. So they have special permits to do special launches for the military of defense.
Okay,
and I know the Falcon Heavy has now with the last launch also. Gone for the qualification for these type of launches. Mm-hmm. But ULA has them already. They've got long heritage with Atlas V and Delta IV to do these type of launches.
Mm-hmm.
So they will still have that position, I think, that they are very reliable.
Okay. So until they start making crappy rockets and the other ones are better, then that's when that would shift.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not a... I guess this market gives a little bit less about shiny new rockets as long as it works.
Exactly, and heritage. I mean, if you look at, for example, those expensive NASA science missions, if you look at the James Webb Space Telescope that will be launched on Ariane 5,
mm-hmm.
But that could also launch on a ULA rocket, but this is all negotiation between NASA, ESA. But I mean, these type of missions, they really want to make sure that these launches go well, and they're not going to put that on the first New Glenn or the first.
Concerning James Webb, is there any sort of rocket with a zero, with so far a zero explosions so far, like a 100% success rate?
No, I don't think so.
No.
Rockets go pop. It's a law of nature.
Yeah. You would hope so. Like, I don't know. I just want them to find like the safest rockets ever existed to launch James Webb. I don't care about anything else. I said that earlier on the show. Like, I'm already tense about that launch. I will not be able to sleep.
Yeah.
Will it go up?
When it goes up in 2060 or whenever. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Will it ever even get launched? So there was news about James Webb actually this week as well. They passed some sort of checkpoint. I don't know what it was, but it's like, I don't know. You see that news every year about James Webb. It's like, another critical checkpoint passed for the James Webb telescope. Yeah, sure. When is it launching? When's that thing launching? Yeah. I don't care about anything else. But thanks, Eric, for the insight.
You're welcome.
Yeah, it felt like to me before the show as if Blue Origin was just like you said, because they were so secretive about it. That also it's hard to get engaged with it because you don't know where it sort of is going. Like a new rocket. Yes, new rocket. But the Moonlander to me was sort of like a kind of weird, like, okay, Moonlander, sure, but yeah. I get the strategy better now.
It was one of the first times they even did a press conference, I think.
Right, yes, it was the first time he stood on a stage with
Elon
a purpose.
Elon Musk is putting out videos all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And all these videos get picked up by new news organizations and networks.
I think something as simple as a Twitter header of SpaceX is Mars being terraformed. And it's like it's instantly clear, like, oh, that's what these guys are doing. Yeah,
yeah.
It's like it's a long-term goal, but it is. Yeah. Eric, for those listeners who stick to the end, you know what's weird? We have talked about about your background yet. And
I told people he is a space engineer.
Yeah, space engineer, exactly. But just
ionorbit.com. Quickly,
yes, ionorbit.com. That's what you run. And I hope to welcome you on the show again in the future. But for future reference, what have you worked on?
I've worked on many European Space Agency missions.
What did you put in space? That's the question.
there is
something with your fingerprints on it.
My fingerprints are, for example, on the OMI instrument on board NASA EOS Aura mission that launched back in 2004. And that was I don't know if you heard about TROP-OMI. I've also worked on that instrument.
Okay.
It's an instrument that looks at the atmosphere of the Earth to measure the ozone layer concentration, all kinds of air quality parameters.
Mm-hmm. And the Aura mission?
The Aura mission did the same, but then back in 2003.
Okay.
I've been one of the people working on building that instrument and testing it. Mm-hmm. So my background is really the system engineering of optomechanical instrumentation for space.
Okay.
It's something not many people can say. I helped build something that's now in space.
No. Yeah. No, exactly.
I envy you, Eric.
Yes. Unless you shoot your ashes up.
I'm not planning to do that.
No, and you won't be able to say that you did so unless you send your pinky in ash form. I would not do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, okay. I still need my bitcoins to go up in value a bit more
before you can pay
my way to space this way.
Exactly. Eric, thank you so much for being on the show. And hope to welcome you in the future. And thanks to all our listeners.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. Thanks, Eric.
Yes.
See you around.
I think one little mention. I think we have a show next week? I think we might not have a show next week.
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And I'll be doing that one with you.
With you. I will not be there.
There will be a big summer space update.
Yes. And from then on, we will be bi-weekly.
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 That's right.
Yes. For the foreseeable future, I think, actually.
Okay.
Yes.
Fair enough.
Especially in summer. Especially in summer.
In the summer to begin with, and the rest remains to be seen.
Yes, and I'll be back. Let's see. When am I on the show? Because the 3rd of July, so next week I'm going to be in an airplane. And then 2 weeks after.
I got it here.
I might be.
It'll be the 31st of July, I think.
Ooh. Yes. So I'll be gone for a little bit.
So we have
a month from now.
A performance by Yuri on the 3rd of July.
And maybe the conversation with Arno, if you can reach
Arno
me,
Wilders.
If I am not in the jungle somewhere,
just call in
Cambodia, then I will call in.
17th of July.
Yes.
And then 31st, you'll be on for sure.
Yes, I will talk to you all later.
And we'll take it from there.
Herbert, you will be here, back here next week.
I'll be minding the business.
Yes, exactly. Guarding the fort.
That's right.
Thank you all. And thank you, Eric. Thank you, Herbert.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.